I'm so happy to speak with Joyce DiDonato, who is a great old friend, a great young friend, young, beautiful friend, I should say. But I've known her for a while. It just seems like yesterday we were talking about Diva Devo in Houston while you were over there doing some performing. And now there's this wonderful release called Drama Queens. Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you, John. My old, young, beautiful friend.
Well, it's funny. I think I first heard of it when I was looking at Carnegie Hall. I love looking at see what their season's coming up. And I was like, Joyce DiDonato, Drama Queens, this has got to be a thing. And sure enough, it was. And I think it's funny. We might normally think opera and passion and all this sort of thing. But I guess a drama queen has got sort of a negative connotation in pop culture.
Really? You know? What are you talking about?
So
the interview's over. The interview's okay, over. You've insulted me.
So how did it come about? How did you choose these things and come up with drama queens?
Well, I knew I wanted to go back to this amazing Baroque world. You know, I keep returning to it. I'll get sidetracked and I'll do a little Rossini, I'll do some Bellini, I'll do some Heggie. But I think the older I get, the more rich I find this period of music. I find, for me, also the greatest amount of freedom in this music, which is odd because it's such a stylized world of, you know, in terms of stylistic boundaries that are on it. But the more I do it, the more free I feel. So I knew I wanted to come back and explore this more. And the names of Cleopatra and Semiramide and Alcina kept coming back to me. And literally, it must have been about 3 or 3:30 in the morning one night. I woke up and I went, they're all drama queens. And I knew I had my title. I think I wrote everybody I knew that next morning. I was like, it's going to be Drama Queens. And I didn't really have the repertoire yet. I just knew what I wanted the project to be about. And so I sat down with Alan Curtis, the conductor on the disc and the creator of Il Complesso Barocco, our fabulous orchestra. And he got like a 12-year-old boy at Christmas with a BB gun, you know, that Christmas story. He was so excited because this is the part of Baroque music that really gets his blood boiling as well. And I said, we need to find some really obscure pieces. And so he went to town. He spent a lot of time in the dusty bookshelves of Berkeley Library and mainly Berkeley, and sort of called in a lot of favors with a lot of people that he knows as well. And sure enough, he has found some unbelievable gems for this disc. And I think way more than half, I can't quite say 2/3, but slightly more than half of these pieces are world premiere recordings. They've never been heard by modern audience. That's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we all know, you know, Handel and Haydn, but when it comes to some of these, we might recognize some of the stories, but it was just a real revelation to go through and go, wow, this is a really amazing rap.
Yeah. Orlandini? Who's that?
Right.
It was funny because he was, again, Alan was in the library in Berkeley, and he was, you know, saying, I need to find, you know, Hasse and Porta and all this. And he looks up on the top shelf and he just sees the spine of a thick manuscript and it says Berenice. And he said, huh, she was a Jewish queen, biblical queen. He goes, I wonder what that is. And then he pulls it out and it was by Orlandini. He said he had heard that this existed, but it was never cataloged. It was totally off the charts. Nobody had ever really... It was a rumor that it existed, and here he was holding it up, and he scoured these dusty manuscript pages, and sure enough, we found two real rocking gems on it, and we put it on the disc, and they're great. They're so much fun.
And I'm amazed in all of this sort of thing, there are things that that come through that are sort of parallels. I think it's cool that the Queen Despised from Monteverdi is followed by this despised bride, you know, you know how these sort of things. And I don't know if that's do you think that's some of the stories and that these composers looked at these things and said, oh, you know, this will make some really great music, or how you know, serendipitous it is to have these sort of things with crying and fire and let me cry or cry my fate. And it just it's amazing, I think, that how these sort of worked.
Let me cry until I die. I mean, that's drama queen, right? It is, but there's also some real joy on this as well, because I think, you know, also the drama queens knew how to celebrate and party probably better than anybody else. What was so, I think, interesting about that time is the monarchy and the royalty of Handel's court of, you know, in England and Germany. They were so untouchable. And yet through the guise of theater, they could put these sorceresses and these ancient queens on stage and watch them suffer and die or exact revenge or destroy the world in the case of Armida. And I think it must have been very cathartic for the public to go and feel like they were living out and seeing the royalty in a way that they weren't allowed to in their everyday life. You know, we think about it now with the royal family in England. You know, these pictures come out with Kate Middleton and everybody's like, oh, it's the biggest news of the day, of the year. And it's this, people want to get inside those lives of the untouchable people. And I think that's one of the reasons the intrigue of this project is so big. You know, you see the hugely powerful, seductive Cleopatra in absolute despair, summoning up just enough courage to say, after I'm dead and gone, I am going to come back as a ghost and I'm going to haunt you and I'm going to make your life really bad. You're going to pay. And then she goes back to despair. But there's something, I think, cathartic about the everyday person to be able to live through that.
Well, I know a lot of these have these wonderful runs and scales that are, you know, I'm sure just incredibly hard to nail. And then at the same time, there are so many that they just melt my heart. The lines come through and it just it's so incredibly beautiful. And I imagine that's one of those things that you have to sit down and go over. And tell us a little bit about your preparation for some of these, because there aren't, as you say, a lot of recordings of these out there.
No, I mean, that was actually the sort of marrying these two worlds that I love so much, the world of the premiere, you know, a world recording that premiere recording that you don't have any history. Jake Heggie's, you know, Dead Man Walking or Resurrection. We've talked about that in the past. So I go back to these pieces that have been sitting on a bookshelf for over 300 years, and there's no tradition. There's no recorded evidence. I have to sort of resurrect it out of nothing. And that's a really exciting scenario for me. It's really liberating and it's really exciting. You feel like you're an archaeologist in a way. Because there weren't a lot of resources for me on the majority of these pieces, I spent hours and hours and hours and hours at the piano just getting to know these women and getting to know the musical language of Hasse or Orlandini and trying to make sure that they were different enough, you know, that so that not all the sorrowful pieces all sounded the same. And that, I think, comes from really making sure each character was really clearly delineated in my mind.
Are there some favorites in here? I would only ask that because I watched your awesome video meeting the orchestra, and I thought, it's always such a hard question. It's I don't know that I can name one, but are there a couple in here that just really speak to you and were like, oh, man, I nailed that. Yeah.
Well, I will say they all – I mean, it's such a stock answer, but they really all do. And that's why every single one of these tracks is on the album. If there wasn't something that I didn't think was spectacular, I wouldn't have put it on. So I do feel like each one of them is my own little child. However, that having been said – now that I'm performing these in front of a public, to see the sort of euphoria that comes from Handel's Brilla nell'alma, it sort of induces this euphoria on the audience, and I see them sort of dancing in their seats. That's pretty exciting. The same time, I'll see, you know, hands wiping cheeks as, you know, literally I can see people crying in the audience, when I'm doing Kaiser's Lasciami piangere, you know, let me weep until I die. That's pretty spectacular. The Porta, Madre Diletta, abbracciami. You know, this is the character of Iphigenie who is going to her death, and she's saying, "Mom, can you please just hold me one more time before I have to go? Oh, and by the way, please forgive Father, because if you don't, I'll never be able to die in peace. But please, can you hold me one more time?" I mean, it's anything but distant and opaque and belonging to another century. It absolutely belongs to today. And this, you know, I think about my nieces going off to college and how really devastated my sister was to have her daughter leave the house, and how scared the daughter was. You know, that's Madre Diletta abbracciami. She's maybe not going to her death. She's thriving in college, I'm happy to say. But it's this moment of saying goodbye and help me. It's very, very human.
Yeah, those sort of emotions, you know, it's like all great literature and music that can speak in any time. You know,
absolutely.
Those things come across, and probably why Porta and Handel, you know, could find things in these stories and bring them to life in their time.
And why they're still true today. I mean, it's extraordinary to me that, let's talk about Kaiser, you know, not a terribly well-known composer, but he wrote this mid-18th century. 200 years later, 250 years later, I'm singing Lasciami Piangere. Nobody's ever heard of it. And I'm breathing life into it. And all of a sudden, it's as if it was written yesterday. And it's moving audiences. That's an extraordinary sensation and experience for me to be a part of. How lucky are we, right?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, we're speaking with Joyce DiDonato, and her latest release is Drama Queens. It's just out, and she's on tour. We'll be in Carnegie Hall later this month, as well as Sonoma. And next spring, I guess winter, if you want to call February, depends on where you're at, in Europe, from Lisbon to Germany and London and Paris. It's a lovely thing. I have to ask about the dress. I have to ask about this red dress.
Oh, that old thing.
I assumed you're wearing it now for the interview here.
I have yet to take it off. Actually, I'm on the plane on this gorgeous dress and people are looking at me a bit strange, but it's okay. I'm glad. Thank you for asking about it. It is a design by Vivienne Westwood, and it is extraordinary. I don't think they've ever done a dress quite like this. I've gotten to know the head of her couture. Now, see, like every once in a while I say a statement like that and I'm like, did I just say that? Is this really happening? What's going on? Yes, I've gotten to know the head of her couture department. And they were very excited because Vivian's a big opera fan and a big culture fan in general. And so I was talking about this. I said it needs to be something extraordinary because the emotional content of this project is quite big. And ideally, you know, for the concerts, the dress could take on different emotions because they're very varied. And I'm sort of very uneloquently dubbing it the Transformer dress because it really it has about 10 different modulations to it that it can do. And it's a fire engine red color with this imprint of, again, a fiery orange spider orchid all over it, which feels sort of very Cleopatra, very Egyptian kind of thing. I like it. But I think if the lighting is right, it almost feels as if the dress is about to burst into flames. It's an extraordinary piece of art and sculpture in a way. And I think it's the perfect dress for this project, you know, because I'm going out there quite audaciously with this title and these big numbers. And I think, you know, the dress has to be a bit audacious as well.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely gorgeous, and I had to ask. I wouldn't normally.
I'm so glad you did.
Well, it is got to be fun to return and work with Alan. And it was so funny. I was going to look it up, and I'd hit translate for something on my computer, and I looked up, and indeed, Il Complesso Barocco had been translated to the complex Baroque, and I thought, that's a great, I hadn't actually thought about that, and it's got to be fun when you have Thurobo and you have harpsichord and these, you know, these great instrumentalists. I was like, that's so fitting. But yeah. I was curious, obviously, Alan, going through and doing some of this research, were there some fun conversations as things came together and the different things that would be coming from Orlandi and Handel and Monteverdi?
Oh, yeah, we spent hours together in a couple different cities. He would, you know, graciously come to where I was rehearsing or performing. And we spent hours at the harpsichord sort of going through these piles of manuscripts he had pulled together. And the discussions were great because the Kaiser, the Lasciami Piangere, I wasn't sold on at first. I looked at it and it kind of went dun da dun da dun da dun da da dun dun. I said, oh, I don't know. It seems kind of banal, Alan. I don't know. And he goes, okay, we won't do it. And then the next time we met up, I think it was in Milan, he comes up. He's like, Joyce, do me a favor. Just take one more look at this. And sure enough, I did. And I was like, he's like, trust me, Joyce, I think this one's really special. And so I took him at his word, and sure enough, we found something great. Same vice versa for the Porta. I looked at it, and I saw this 12/8 Siciliana time signature, and I went, oh, Alan, he's like, oh, I don't know. It seems kind of trite, you know, and I convinced him. So there was a little bit of posturing for which pieces we both wanted on there. But then there were things like Cleopatra, Piangero, and the Disprezzata Regina of Monteverdi that we knew immediately had to be a part of this. And so there were some things that fell into place really easily. Yeah. And what was fun about the Monteverdi, I mean, you talk about freedom. I mean, in a modern context today, we are as essentially composers as well. I mean, there's so many different versions that exist of it. You have to choose which one you want to do. You have to choose the instrumentation. All you really have is a figured bass on this music, and we're able to add, you know, the viola di gamba on the Monteverdi, which is an extraordinary sound. It's really wah, 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 wah. It's a great sound that adds so much color to her despair. And, you know, we're able to sort of discuss about color and accent and dynamics. And it's a really creative process to be a part of.
Oh, yeah. And it comes through, I imagine, it's nice now that we can all hear it where it's released on iTunes and Amazon and different places. But now folks are actually being able to hear it in person, and it's coming to life again through these with interpretations. Are there some times where it's like, oh, I'm going to push this section a little bit tonight? Are there some fun things when you're working with friends that you've already recorded with to see how this section goes or that section goes?
Oh, absolutely. You know, so we've done 5 concerts already and have about almost 20 more ahead of us over the next year. Every single performance has been different. And, you know, it's on stage, it's a group of 13, 14 musicians. So it's a real chamber ensemble. That means every musician on the stage is a soloist, essentially. And they're all listening and responding in such a really active way. You know, one of the pieces we do, Brilla nell'alma, we just do a reprise of it for an encore if the public insists. And it's always very different from what we just did 10 minutes earlier. You know, it's usually Dimitri, our first violinist, is pushing the tempo a little bit more. I'm like, whoa, okay. I'm buckling my seatbelt. We are out of the gates on this one. But that's the beauty of live music. You know, it has its own heartbeat. It has its own pulse. And I think that's why it's in so much demand.
Yeah. Well, it is an awesome recording, and we're looking forward to hearing it here on Texas Public Radio, and as audiences get to hear it over the next year. It's really awesome stuff, Joyce.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate that.
You were just in the same breath as Gustavo Dudamel became Vocalist of the Year for Musical America, and they've been around for quite a while. I was looking up, I think the first award went to Leonard Bernstein back in '62. or 61, 62. Gosh. And he won
it. For Vocalist of the Year?
Yes. It's like, yeah, no, well, it's funny. He won again. He like became another award winner in like 88 or 89
wow.
or something rather. It's like, holy cow. But then I think in the 90s, they started Vocalist of the Year. And it's, I thought maybe Sam might have beat you to it, but it looks like you are the first Shocker, the first Wichita State graduate to ever get a Musical America Award. I went through the whole list and I thought that was pretty cool, but it's got to be kind of neat to have this is a pretty the list is amazing, all these great singers, and here you are the 2013 winner.
It's quite humbling, I'll tell you. It's so funny that you bring up Wichita State because my connection to Musical America is very personal. I was finishing my undergrad. I'd done my student teaching. I had almost had my degree in music education, but I knew I was wanting to sort of pursue the idea of being an opera singer, but I didn't have a clue as to what the next stage should be. I knew that I didn't want to sit more time and spend more time in a classroom studying music history and writing papers and all that. I wanted to be on stage learning my craft. So I literally went into the music library. You remember right there on that first floor and pulled off the dusty old Musical America off the shelf. And they have a big section in there about training and education. And they list all the young artist programs and the conservatories and all this. And that's where I found the listing for the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, which I had not heard of at that time. And do you know, I wrote down all the institutions, and that is the only one that I contacted because they dealt primarily with opera. So in a way, it's coming full circle that in Musical America, that publication literally put me on the next step for me to becoming what I am today, and ended up for 3 years at the Academy of Vocal Arts. So it's a very personal – I get to thank them actually in person when I go to the award ceremony. That'll be fun.
Yeah, they're a great resource, and these days put out all this stuff on the web and still have that wonderful guide in print and online. So it's great stuff.
Yeah, and indispensable.
Yeah. And if you can't get to Sonoma or New York, you'll be at the Met with an international broadcast in January, and it starts up later here in December. You're returning as Mary Queen of Scots. How fun is this? Because I was like, this is a
Met. Oh, my
Met.
God. She's this also a drama queen.
Oh, my God.
Go figure. Oh, my God.
And this is a Met premiere. I was like, wow, I had no idea.
Yeah. It was famous in New York at the City Opera, at New York City Opera with Beverly Sills. But the Met, believe it or not, has never done it. So, you know, that is not a small task that I have been charged with. I'm a little bit daunting, a little bit scary, but all in the good ways, you know, meaning I have to rise to the challenge and hopefully hit it way out of the park.
Yeah. Well, it's again, a juicy role, and what great music to have surround you with this. I mean, it's Donizetti's hard to beat.
Oh, it's extraordinary. It has one of the most famous confrontational scenes in all of opera, where it's the fictional meeting of Mary and Elizabeth, but it's from the Schiller play. And I try to sort of, you know, faintly ask her to forgive me, which is a very difficult thing for me to do. And she has none of it. And I turn around on her. I say, well, then this was very scandalous in the day. I call her a vil bastarda, which means a vile bastard. And bastard in the sense of you are illegitimate because, you know, your father, King Henry VIII, was not exactly, it's complicated with the old Tudors. But it's a great confrontational scene. The music is extraordinary. And that's in HD Cinemas, the Met Live at HD on January 19.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome stuff. A romantic role that's not a pants role either. Yeah, indeed.
I get to wear a skirt. And a crown, maybe.
Oh, man. Well, Joyce, it is a busy time, so we will let you go. And it's awesome to hear you, and it's great to catch up. And we'll look for you. I know you are amazing. You do these videos, you tweet, and there's Joyce DiDonato on Facebook, where you share things. It's pretty neat.
I'm just trying to keep up with you, John Clare.
Well, it's awesome stuff, and it's so good. I can't wish more great things on a sweeter, wonderful person.
You are the best. Thank you, John.